This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
Welcome to A Conversation with History. I'm Harry Kreisler of the Institute of International Studies. Our guest today is Harriet Mayer Fulbright, who is the Harvest Distinguished Woman Lecturer on the Berkeley campus this semester, and she is a co-founder of the Harriet Mayer Fulbright College. She served in the Clinton administration as executive director of President Clinton's Committee on the Arts and the Humanities, and she has been an unofficial ambassador for the Fulbright program. Mrs. Fulbright, welcome to Berkeley.
Thank you so much. I'm glad to be here.
Where were you born and raised?
I was born in New York City. My father was on the business end of Time magazine, and he was constantly opening new offices, so we did a fair amount of moving.
And looking back, how did your parents shape your thinking about the world?
They shaped it fundamentally because my father really strongly believed in connections around the world as the only way we were going to be saved, in fact. So there was constant conversation, even when I was little, about other parts of the world. And in fact, he sent me to Latin America when I was 15 for
and,
that
and
reason.
And what about your mother? What was her?
My mother was unfortunately killed in a skiing accident when I was 12. And that was very hard on the family, as you can imagine. I was the oldest of four, and I was only 12. Mm-hmm. But he did marry a couple of years later, a wonderful woman who is still alive and who became an integral part of our family.
Did you wind up traveling with your father or living abroad when you were still very young?
Yes. He was actually, his home was physically moved to places. We started in New York, moved to Philadelphia. During the Second World War, we lived in Washington. Then he moved to Europe. Paris. By that time, I was not. I was in college, and I wasn't with the family all the time. But yes, I obviously visited him as he moved.
And where did you do your undergraduate work?
My undergraduate work was at Radcliffe College, and graduated from there.
And what did you major in?
International relations. Mm.
And did you do a study abroad, or did they have study abroad then?
It was a very narrow and difficult type of program, so no, I did not study abroad there and didn't feel particularly the need to, since my family was educating me in that fashion.
And so out of college, what career choice did you make, or is that when did you have your first living abroad, education abroad experience?
That was, when I was in my 20s, I believe, and I lived for 2 years in the Soviet Union, and that was quite an extraordinary experience.
And this would have been what years, approximately?
In the 1950s.
In the 1950s. And what was that like? Because that must have been at the height of the Cold War.
It was the height of the Cold War.
Were you afraid?
I wasn't afraid. I was frustrated. I knew we were going. This was with my first husband, and I knew we were going to live there. And so I studied Russian very hard, and I'm pretty good at languages. So when I got there, I could make normal conversation. I traveled to keep my sanity, and some of those travels were quite extraordinary and made me realize that this regime's days were numbered.
And was there a lot of interaction with the people of the Soviet Union?
Only surreptitiously. There was one time when I took a trip to Tashkent and to visit schools, and at one point the student teachers, after when I tried to leave that afternoon, went to the principal and said, "We have to show that we're polite. We have to escort her back to her hotel." And as soon as I got to the sidewalk, they said, "Where do you really want to go?" And it was an incredible evening.
So the beginnings of the dissident movement were apparent. Absolutely. To anybody who talked to the people.
Yes, and it was clear that there was no way that it could last, because at the end of that evening, one of the young men pulled out this Time magazine, mm-hmm. and smoothed it out, and there was a picture of an apartment building, an American apartment building. And he said, "You see that picture?" And I said, "Yes." Mm-hmm. And he said, "You see what the name of it is?" And it was an apartment building. It was marked slums. Mm-hmm. He said, "To us, that's a nice apartment building. Mm-hmm. What else are they lying to us about?" I thought, oh boy, deep trouble.
So now, when was your education abroad experience in Colombia? Was that early?
That was when I was only 15, mm-hmm. and I was in high school, of course. And I spent 3 solid months in Bogota, and went to the Gimnasio Femenino, mm-hmm. and that was in order to not just improve my Spanish, but to realize how very different life was in other countries.
Mm-hmm. And so in both cases, you acquired some language skills.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Oh, yes. I spoke Russian, and I did speak Spanish, yes. Mm-hmm.
Did this get you the foreign travel, foreign education, abroad bug? Very early.
Oh, yes.
So you wanted to do more and so on. Yeah. And what were you doing after you graduated from college beyond going to these
places? At that point, my first husband was a Foreign Service officer.
I see.
So after 2 years in Washington, we moved, and I spent 2 years in Korea, and I immediately went to try to find work. I taught English and creative writing at Ewha Women's University.
Mm-hmm. Which is in Korea?
Yes. South Korea,
right.
Yes, in Seoul.
So you were building up quite a portfolio at a very young age.
Right.
Did you learn Korean then?
Oh,
or
yes.
Some Korean?
I did, yes. And I worked at it very hard. I hate being in a place where I don't know what's going on. I can't, mm-hmm. you know.
And Korea must have been a very different place back then,
because
there was still a dictatorship.
Actually, Syngman Rhee had just fled to Hawaii when I arrived, and they were thrilled with their newfound freedom. And I did get a job at the Korea Times, which was their English language paper. And I corrected their English.
Mm-hmm. But the economic miracle had not occurred then.
No. They were just beginning to get off their feet and beginning to build.
I'm curious what your conclusion then and now is about what the skills required for being an education abroad student. Obviously, language.
But you also have to have an open mind. The open mind is equally as important as the language, because perhaps it's not quite so different now, because we are, you know, communication is so extraordinary. But I'll never forget one of the first conversations I had in the school in Bogota when I was able to converse. They asked me why I didn't do this at the beginning of every class, and I said, "Because I'm not a Catholic, I'm a Protestant." And they looked at me, and he said, "Oh, do you believe in God?" You know, the ignorance on both sides was just enormous.
Mm-hmm. So at one level, being abroad for the first time is disorienting.
True.
And so it requires navigation.
Correct.
of your environment. And I guess I'm curious about the emotional side. In the beginning, you're intimidated, I guess. You're taken aback, and then as you learn to respect what you're seeing, does that change? You evolve.
Yes, I think maybe intimidated is a little strong.
Yeah.
I think you realize that you have to watch what you say because it could be so easily misinterpreted, and you're trying to make connections, and so you're asking more questions.
Cautious.
Yes, you're very cautious. Exactly.
Right. And is it by getting to know people, making friends, interacting both socially and whatever you're doing there that you find their humanity?
You find their humanity
and your own,
you find that their differences are not threatening but simply differences.
Mm-hmm. And is it better to come with the language skills when you're immersed in a society, can you just pick that up?
I think you have to have a modicum of language skills. I think you have to have a way of at least stumbling through introductions and connections, because otherwise, what are you, just a post?
Mm-hmm. And in the case of, you were young in Bogota, you were a little older in the Soviet Union.
Absolutely.
In both cases, had you been exposed to the history or the culture?
I exposed myself, yes.
Yeah. But before you actually went?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. And was there a lot of difference from what you read in the books to what you were experiencing?
Not that much. The books were pretty good about describing what society was like and what their modes of living were.
And what about the temperament of a person who aspires to be a foreign exchange student? Both then and now. I guess now it's easier.
Much easier.
But when you were doing it, foreign territory was really foreign territory.
It was totally foreign.
Yeah.
It was totally foreign.
So what is required?
An open mind. And a willingness to ask all kinds of questions, mm-hmm. and a willingness to give of yourself and realize that sometimes you might be misunderstood, but that's what it is, a misunderstood standing. It's not hostility.
Mm-hmm. But so then, in your time, it was about courage. In a way, courage, is that the right word?
I guess that's a good word.
Yeah. Patience?
Patience was essential.
Yeah.
Of yourself as well as others.
Right. And did you then experience a lot of frustration?
Of course.
Yeah.
Yes.
Now, to what extent do you think? Now we'll talk about foreign exchange generally in a minute. But do you think, from your own experience, that it would have made you a better negotiator? Because people are always talking about knowing your adversary knowing the person you have to. Mm-hmm. Do you agree with that based on that experience?
Yes, I think so. And not only patience, but a large amount of understanding, because a lot of the hostility of people who come from foreign lands is simply they don't understand where they're coming from.
Now, when you went, you were an American.
Oh, yes.
America was all-powerful in the world. How did that, do you think, in retrospect, impacted the way you were perceived? In other words, I guess in a way, discovering your humanity for the other made it a step toward better understanding the United States? A little step.
I think that when we got talking and they realized that I really did know something and respected their society, then I became a human being rather than an American.
Mm-hmm.
And that made a huge difference.
And would they would ask you, you use the example of the apartment house in Time magazine, so there must have been a stream of questions coming at you about movies, about restaurants, about all sorts of things.
Yes. And I welcomed them because, you know, and admitted, you know, our shortcomings, which Lord knows we had then, and every country still does.
Of course, now a student goes abroad and they can Skype their family back home. They can use a computer and use FaceTime and so on. But that was a very different world. Oh, you were there and you were
different.
There.
That's correct.
So was it all letter writing back home?
It was all letter writing. There was nothing else. I mean, computers, no, that they didn't operate that way. And so we always had lag time.
Right. Now, later in life, you married Senator William Fulbright.
That's right.
And let's talk about him. As a political leader, a distinguished statesman, before we talk about his political and talk a little about him as a personality, because he's obviously a very important historical figure in the consciousness and the history of this country.
He was an amazing human being, and I met him because of the fact that two friends of mine knew that I had just come off an important job at the National Gallery, and they said, "This is going to be really different, Harriet, but it's equally important. We want you to start an alumni association for the Fulbright program." And it was a huge job because, you know, there were records, thousands of records that I had to gather from separate colleges and so forth. But it was an idea whose time had really come. People welcomed it. And so my job was trying to keep up with the enthusiastic responses that were coming in.
And this is how you met Senator Fulbright?
Of course.
Right.
And he was so pleased that this was happening.
Right. And was he, he obviously was a very, he was both a political leader, a statesman, but he was also something of an intellectual.
He was a tremendous intellectual. He'd had a Rhodes Scholarship. He'd spent at least 2 years in England, and the Rhodes set up these tutorials. He was working with one particular professor, McCallum, at Oxford, and it was intense. He told me it was the most intense educational experience that he'd ever had.
And so he was born and raised in Arkansas, and then he as a young man was a Rhodes Scholar. This would have been in the 30s, or do you? That's
right, yes.
Yeah.
And he traveled, obviously, by train to New York City in order to catch a boat, and New York shocked him to the core. He never got over that.
Because he was from
Fayetteville.
Yeah. So I'm looking for the word. So he had been raised in a provincial setting. So
definitely.
Just, yeah.
I mean, the houses in his city at that time were two stories, you know?
Right.
And there he arrived
at
this extraordinary city that was full of noise and rushing and 8 million people.
And do you know how he happened to apply for the Rhodes?
Yes, it was in his senior year. He was a very good student.
And he was a student at the University of Arkansas?
Arkansas.
Yeah.
And his English professor came and said, "What are you going to do when you leave?" "Oh, I don't know." Mm-hmm. And so he said, "You should apply for a Rhodes Scholarship." And he looked into it, and he thought, "Well, that's interesting." Mm-hmm. And he talked to his family, and they thought it was a wonderful idea. He had a wonderful mother, especially his father died early. And so he applied, and he got it.
Mm-hmm. And then when he came back to Arkansas.
Yes.
And let me ask
but
you this.
It was a hiatus. He came back and landed in Washington.
I see.
And he met a very attractive young lady and decided he wanted to spend a little time here, so he applied for a job and became a professor there for a couple of years before going back.
And his field was history or government?
It's constitutional law.
Constitutional law. Mm-hmm. So did he get the law degree as a Rhodes Scholar, or did he come back and do that?
Came back and did that in Washington.
I see. And where did he do that?
George Washington
George
University.
Washington University, okay.
That's where he got his
law
degree.
But then he went back to Arkansas.
Yes, he did.
And became president
He first a professor and then president.
Right. Was that for 2 years?
Yes.
And then he ran for the Senate? Was that?
No, he ran for an office in the legislature. He actually had a former student of his come to him who was the representative for Arkansas, for that district in Arkansas, and he said to Fulbright, "You always told us that democracy won't work unless the best and the brightest run for office. Now I'm going to make you put your money where your mouth is. You are going to have to take my office or run for my office because I'm leaving it as at the end of this term." And he thought about it, and he went to his wife, Betty, and they agreed, and he ran for it, and he got the office as a legislator. Within a year.
And that is to the National Congress?
To the National Congress.
Right.
He was in the House of Representatives. And within a year, the Senate, one of the two Senate offices was about to open because the senator said he was not going to run in the next election. And immediately a man that Fulbright had no respect for said he was going to run for that Senate seat. I can't let that happen. I can't work under that man. So he ran for the Senate seat, and he got it. Mm-hmm. So he was only for 1 year in the House.
Now, we're going to talk about his contribution to international education, but I think I want to first start with his role as a visionary with regard to U.S. foreign policy and mm-hmm. America's role in the world. We'll mm-hmm. get to the international
okay.
education part in a moment. So. His situation was complicated in the sense that he came from a southern state, and to get reelected, he was not in the forefront on civil rights.
He had to stay in the background,
yeah.
or he wouldn't have been reelected. That's,
right.
Back then, that was the case.
And so his personal views must have been very different
yes.
from what he had to do as a
yes.
politician.
Yes.
Now, he ultimately becomes chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee.
Correct.
And his expertise is really on international relations, and that's
exactly
really where
correct.
He made his mark. And his vision, his vision was one in which he saw that America and the U.S. had to restrain itself because it had so much power.
Had to restrain itself in terms of the power part, but had to reach out a great
right.
deal in terms of international relations, because this is a huge country with water on two sides.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's not as if you're living in Europe and saying, oh, yes, you know, if it's Tuesday, this must be Belgium, and I'm going to drive 4 hours and be in another country.
Right.
And the mentality is hugely different.
Mm-hmm. And did he ever talk to you about his role in with regard to the opposing the Vietnam War and those
oh,
kinds
it
of
killed him.
Yeah.
Yes.
And when you say it killed him, in what sense? Because he was so frustrated that in other words, his vision
yes.
told him that this was all wrong and
That's
so on.
That's right. That's correct.
Yeah. And did he kept at it, And the Fulbright hearings, of course, are one of the – it's really where the establishment embraces the consciousness of the people in the street mm-hmm. who are opposing the war.
And he had to do that so, so carefully.
Yeah. In what sense? I mean
– Well, in the sense that he couldn't come blasting out with – criticisms and feelings of what we really should be doing. He had to do it by questioning. He had to do it by holding infinite hearings in the Senate and bringing young people, John Kerry being one of them, mm-hmm. to talk about, views on.
So in other words, he was very conscious of the need for a discovery process.
Correct.
And so through
yes.
questioning and so on, I guess his Oxford education must have really helped him.
Tremendous. I don't think he could have done that without it.
Now, did that affect him at home in Arkansas? Was Arkansas such a provincial place that, in a way, this public vision for America's global role had a negative impact in Arkansas?
It had an initial negative impact, but he was always reaching out to his own constituent, his own state. And I'll never forget a letter that he received fairly far into the process, which said, I never voted for you. I never lost an opportunity to denigrate you. But I'm slowly beginning to realize the real profound understanding you have and the rightness of your position. And he said, make no mistake, my friend, when we all meet our maker and others coming will be standing our shoulders, the person standing on your shoulders will be a little higher than others. And mm-hmm. I thought that was a beautiful letter.
As a Fulbright ambassador later in your career, you had the opportunity to visit Vietnam, mm-hmm. not with the senator, but talk about that mm-hmm. experience. The recognition you were given, yeah.
And I hasten to add, I was an unofficial, and I didn't have that title, but
right.
I was an unofficial ambassador, you might say. And it was an extraordinary experience because I was greeted with open arms because of the senator's work. And I went to classrooms and spoke to them and got wonderful. But at one point, I was sitting with a group describing certain things, and suddenly down the steps came this little, very energetic man, and he sat next to me, and he grabbed my shoulders, and he kissed me on both cheeks, and he said, Senator Fulbright, he was the only one who understood the Vietnamese people, and it was General Giap.
Mm-hmm. Who was the architect of the Vietnam war on the Vietnamese side.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yes.
So that must have been a moving
experience. It was amazing.
And he just recently passed away.
Yes, he did. Yes, he did. He was an extraordinary man.
And back to the Congress, what this courageous stand by Senator Fulbright really affected his relationship with President Johnson, who I think he had been close to in
That's
an earlier
correct.
Period
yes.
and had actually sponsored the Gulf of Tonkin resolution.
Right.
But then he came to realize that he had been had by the president.
That's correct. Yes.
So their relations soured.
It very much soured, yeah. yes. Yes.
And what about his fellow congressmen? I mean, was this an educational process for his fellow senators also?
Some of them, yes, and some of them spoke to him privately, but publicly they had to keep their distance. That's mm. very true.
And so what were, when you would talk to Senator Fulbright about this, what was his overall lesson learned from that experience?
A lesson for himself?
Yeah, for himself, yeah.
It was I think a lesson that he basically deep down understood even before, you know, it was happening, but it was just that people have to understand changes in the world in a very slow, deliberative, and educational way. You can't suddenly have an epiphany and expect other people to follow.
Mm-hmm. Now, the other vision that Fulbright brought to the table came from his Rhodes Scholar experience. That is, he came to see the importance on the one hand,
yes.
He saw that military power wasn't the end-all and be-all, but on the other hand, what we now call soft power, international education, was an instrument for enhancing America's power and changing the world.
That is correct. And during the Second World War, toward the end of the Second World War, he was in Congress by that time. And he said he stopped and he thought, why are we in a world war within two generations of the first? This is insanity. This is self-destruction. And in deeply thinking about it and through his experiences as Rhodes Scholar and world traveler, he realized it has to do with basic misunderstanding and lack of knowledge of other people, and how do we overcome that? And that was his legislation creating the Fulbright Scholarship. That's why it happened.
And this was very early. This
oh,
would have
yes.
been in the 40s? Or?
46 was 40. When the...
So he was in Congress.
Yes,
then.
He was.
Right.
And 46 was when the first... legislation was signed to establish this scholarship, and he was a very wily politician because that piece of legislation had no money attached.
Mm-hmm.
And so when it went through, people looked, other congressmen
yeah.
looked, no money, oh, who cares mm-hmm. what, so immediately it passed.
Mm-hmm.
Then he said, how am I going to pay for it?
Mm-hmm.
And a few months later, coming across his desk was a piece of legislation allowing for, or actually promoting, the sale of all the amazing amounts of not just munitions, but jeeps and medical supplies, et cetera, that were lying all over the world where we were fighting. And it was for we were going to sell it to the country where it lay.
Mm-hmm.
And he thought, I've got it. And at the bottom of that piece of legislation, he wrote, these funds shall be limited to the underwriting of the International Education Exchange Program. And that was the beginning of how we paid for it.
So it's a case where, in one sense, people didn't know what he was doing.
No, he was very happy.
So it was kind of under the table,
yes.
covert, whatever the word is.
So true. And 6 months after that, after that passed and it was all in place and there was nothing that could be done to change it without really uproar, a senator came to him and shook his finger in his face, and he said, young man, if I had known what you were up to, I would have put it so fast to stop. Don't you realize how horrible it is to expose our fine young boys and girls to those dangerous foreign isms?
I see. That's really... And was the original conception sending Americans
That's
abroad,
what Fulbright.
But not yet bringing foreigners here?
That's correct.
Right.
That came when everybody realized what a tremendous benefit it was.
And Fulbright's idea was that if you go abroad and you experience these cultures, that on the one hand, the other country citizen will gain a kind of respect and affection for America and American mores, and on the other hand, the American will learn about the foreign country and come back as a teacher,
yes,
or whatever.
Yes, and realize that the differences are not evil or wrong. Mm. They're differences, and that we can live with them. And as a matter of fact, if we do live with them, we become better people.
Mm-hmm. And so how many years has the Fulbright program been in existence?
The first legislation was signed in 46.
And the first fellows were in 47?
In 48, the first fellows went in both directions, to the east and to the west.
And was it only academics and professors? At that time. And from all disciplines?
Yes.
For all disciplines.
Yes.
And then when did the program evolve into one that would bring foreigners here?
That actually was a few years later, when other countries realized what a tremendous benefit it was, and they began to offer to contribute to the program in their country. And I think by this time, it's something like 14 different countries actually contribute more than half the funds necessary for the Fulbright program in their country.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned earlier that when you became involved with the Fulbright program, it was part of your job was building a historical record of all of the fellows. What were the numbers like? I mean, over the years, approximately how many people have participated in this program?
Oh, Lord. When I was doing it, which was years ago, it was over 300,000. Mm-hmm. So obviously the number, I haven't kept up with the exact figures, but it's probably more than 500,000 by this time.
Right. And presumably the sale of the military goods, you know, expired sometime
yes.
shortly. That
They expired about six, seven or eight years after that.
Right. Yeah. And at that point, was the Congress willing to fund
yes.
it?
Yes. Yes. Right. By that time, they really understood what the benefits were.
So this became an instrument of American soft power.
Correct.
at the height of the Cold War, because this
Correct.
Really is started before
yes.
the Cold War, beginning. What did Fulbright see as his greatest achievement? Both the foreign policy vision that he brought to the table and this, or was this his favorite child?
I think this was his favorite child, right. Yes. It really was.
Did he often meet with the Fulbright fellows themselves?
Yes, yeah. He did. He did. Right. And he loved sitting around a table with them. That was a real pleasure, because he got real conversation from them.
Now, in the Clinton administration, you were the chairman of the Arts Council.
It was the Arts and Humanities. Yes, it was.
And in that program, the goal was to bring private foundations and the private sector together with government support the arts and
the humanities. When I was there, it was strictly through the United States. Mm-hmm. I talked about, you know, an international, but I was too busy trying to get the United States. I just talked about it. Subsequently, they not only talked about it, they did begin to spread their wings abroad.
To what extent has that knowledge been applied to the Fulbright? In other words, is there private support in the United States for Fulbright fellowships, or is the only source of new funding the countries themselves?
No, there is some private, especially through colleges and universities who understand what a tremendous benefit it is. Yes.
Now, the world that in which you were a foreign exchange student and the world that where Fulbright's vision was founded is a different world than the world that we have today.
Totally.
On the one hand, there's the decline of American power, the rise of the others, and on the other hand, there is the diversity that we have on a campus like Berkeley, and really now all universities are so diverse that often the Anglo-Saxon population, you know, is a minority.
That's right.
Among minorities, yes. Basically, and so on. Students who go abroad can Skype, can mm-hmm. do FaceTime, can send email, and so on. So does this suggest that the Fulbright program has to change, and in what ways would it have to change?
I don't think so. I think that, and furthermore, the Fulbright program started changing from the time that it was first instituted because of the fact that there was interest and therefore an interest in getting involved in it as well from other countries and in supporting the program through their own funding. And so it's been a constant evolution. It's not just a sudden change.
And so do you see any new goals for international education? I mean, in other words, is the vision one that remains resilient, or have there been major adaptions by the Fulbright program?
Oh, I think that the adaptions are not so much on the fundamental level, but on the addition of, for instance, disciplines that didn't even exist when it first began, and exchanges with countries that also perhaps didn't exist or certainly were not part of an international community. Mm-hmm. That's where the constant change comes.
What happens to, I assume there's still congressional funding.
Yes.
Yeah. So what happens in a world where the vision of a faction of a party is so narrow, so provincial, that if this faction were running the state of Arkansas back when Senator Fulbright, went to Oxford, they wouldn't let him go, because, in other words, he would, as one of the best and the brightest, he
yeah.
would be tainted mm-hmm. by what he might experience. I mean, it's a very different. It's not the entire environment in the Congress, but it's
definitely
by a faction that has used its veto power to in some distorted way impose its vision on the country.
But I don't think that the international education is something that they have focused on.
Yet.
You're quite right. If they do, I'm going to start getting up on a soapbox.
Right.
But it's not for them, it's not important enough to start trying to block.
What would Senator Fulbright think of all of this? If he were now, on the one hand,
yeah.
he was aware of people in his own district, in his own state, who basically he couldn't confront on certain issues. But, it's almost obvious, but is there some particular perspective that he would bring that, knowing him so well and so on?
Well, there's one little story that I think I need to tell you, because a lot of this he treated with humor and that was, he was sitting with one of his constituents and they were talking about the venal and horrible and satanic influence of those commies mm-hmm. and how awful it was and what we've got to do something about it. And at that point, Fulbright looked at him and then he got up. He said, "Commies?" And he started looking under the furniture, and he said, "Commies? Where are they?"
So it must be very hard for somebody like Senator Fulbright, who's also a politician in some sense, who part of his constituency is he's able to see so much more than the narrowest, most provincial visionaries in his own constituency. Mm-hmm. How did he deal with that? I mean, is it you obviously try to bring them along, as you said, he tried to bring along senators to his vision of the Vietnam War, but he must have developed a remarkable set of skills.
I think those skills were factual material. Now, you know, when he'd get these barrages at him, he'd say, "Now, what harm have they really done? What are they focusing on that is hitting at our hearts?" Mm-hmm. And then he would describe the fact that they weren't.
That is the communists.
Very specifically. Yeah, yeah. Not just commies, but other people who were trying to.
So it's a question of going back to his role as an educator to sort of focus on the facts. What is
That's
the reality
exactly right.
versus
yes.
what are bad ideas about
yes.
the reality?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. And he tried to do it gently. Mm-hmm. He was never a proponent of, you know, hitting a person square mm-hmm. in the face.
So he lived his educational philosophy.
Yes, he did. Yes, he really
now,
did.
Now, President Clinton awarded him the Medal of Freedom.
That's correct. Right?
And this must have been a moving occasion
for him. Oh, it was amazing.
Him. Yeah.
Yes, obviously I attended, and it was amazing. And it was very emotional for both of them.
Now, and Clinton had worked for him, right, in his office and his congressional
That's
office.
That's correct.
And they didn't agree about everything back then.
It was so funny. They did. They didn't. But he would do whatever he could to not only to help in the office, but to be close to him. And so he immediately offered to be his driver. Mm-hmm. And he would drive him to his various meetings around the city, or if it was here. And he would talk as he was driving. Mm-hmm. And I remember one time Bill smiling and talking about one time when he said, "Young man, you might be really good at politics, but you are a lousy driver. Do you realize the sun is on the wrong side of this car for where we're going?"
So Clinton was already politicking.
Oh, he was.
Climbing up the ladder. So looking back at your career, your experiences with the Fulbright program, what advice would you give students as they're preparing for their future?
I would say that an international experience is more important than ever. And also higher education is more important than ever. So nowadays, a BA is more and more often not the last degree that you need. It is a higher one.
And what do you see as the inspirational story of Senator Fulbright that they should be aware of?
That's a really interesting question because there are so many stories.
But the big picture, you know, account of him. I mean, it's about courage and knowledge and fighting the good fight.
And fighting the good fight without fighting, but educating.
Mm-hmm. Which is important.
Yes.
Yeah, and that's what he was trying to do in the Vietnam.
That's exactly correct.
Right.
Yes.
Well, Mrs. Fulbright, I want to thank you very much for coming on our program and for being the first Harvest lecturer for distinguished women.
I can't thank you enough for having me.
And thank you very much for joining us for this conversation with history.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.